Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, some of us this Sunday will forego the obligatory brunch or card wishing our dads a happy Father's Day simply because we don't have one. All too often we hear stories of fathers as the perpetrators of abuse, abandoning their families, defaulting on child support, or worse. And in African American communities, single motherhood has reached huge proportions, even more than in the rest of America, where it has also reached huge proportions. But what about the fathers who stay, especially in the face of harrowing odds, to raise their children at any cost? Take the father of author Ta-Nehisi Coates, the subject of his new book, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. His father really is the subject. As Ta-Nehisi writes, his father was determined to raise him and his siblings right, whether they liked it or not, in a tough Baltimore environment. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. And most often we did not like it.
Oh, really? Like, what didn't you like about it?
Well, I think it goes with the territory. You know, the interests of children and the interests of parents are often at odds, as I'm finding out. I have a young 7-year-old son myself. And so I think it was naturally just supposed to be that way. And my father, I think more so than other fathers, was weird, just a different sort of father with different priorities.
So most people would have considered your father's direction and leadership a gift, or maybe we only consider our parents, you know, discipline, if that's the right word, a gift after we've grown up.
Yeah, I mean, I knew probably by the time I was 11 or 12 that I had, I mean, if you had asked me, I would have said I had a good father. There would have been no question. Yeah. I would have said by virtue of having a father that I had a good father. And then I would have went on to tell you why. At the same time, I think emotionally, I mean, on one level, as I say in the book, there were so many kids, so many of my friends either did not know their fathers or just didn't have fathers who were present in their lives. And so at the time, you know, they were given what looked like liberties. And so I guess for some period of my life, I always resented the fact that I couldn't get away with certain things. Of course, you know, later in your life, you're very thankful for that.
And you compare growing up in West Baltimore in the 1980s to, quote, groping for manhood in the dark.
Yes.
What does that phrase mean?
Well, just that I think some when you're lacking for models, that I think there were just not enough places around where you could say, okay, this is what it means to be a man. I think kids in those sorts of environments often go for the lowest common denominator, that being brute force, crude expressions of sexuality.
So set the scene for us. What was a young man like you up against at that place and at that time?
So much of, you know, so it was, there was the bigger environmental things going on. I mean, it was obviously crack hit Baltimore in the mid-80s and just changed the fabric of everything. Guns, you know, suddenly more accessible to young people. HIV, which we have all this knowledge, even though we haven't found the cure, we have all this knowledge of what HIV is. Now, at the time, it was just something that people caught and then they died. And we had no idea. I mean, obviously, we knew it was sexually transmitted, IV drug users, et cetera. But in the early days of that, it just seemed so mysterious to us. So there was that. But I think so many of my obstacles had to do with who I was. I've long thought that I was a kid with attention deficit disorder who went misdiagnosed. When I was young, they didn't call it that. Mm-hmm. And so I was just a sort of spacey kid at a time when you really, really could not afford to be spacey, when you had to be aware of everything that was going on around you.
And yet when you talk about growing up in Baltimore, in the book, you describe your father's frequent frustrations with how you approach life, both on the streets and in the classroom.
Yes, yes, yes. He, if it was one word that he would have, you know, given to me, it would just have been just greater awareness. And I think, as I said before, you know, I was most interested in the story going on in my own head, not the story that, you know, was going on up and down the street, not the story that my teacher was telling. I wanted to be interested in what I was interested in.
And we can take some phone calls for Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. Anyone else want to grow up, talk about growing up maybe in similar environs, maybe in urban neighborhoods at around the same time in the 80s at the height of the crack epidemic and when awareness of AIDS was new and some of the other things that he's been referencing? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or anyone else for Ta-Nehisi Coates this morning, 212-433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You chronicle your father's life in explicit detail.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to know the details of your father's life? Did you interview him, in effect, for the book?
I did, and you know, like, as much stuff in there as there is that's just sort of, you know, just laying him naked, most of that stuff was known to me. Again, it was not known, as you said, in the detail, but this was actually his idea. It started with what he thought would be an interesting conversation between two generations of black men, dealing with fatherhood, dealing with coming of age. It sort of shifted in its focus and how it was written once it came time to do that, but it was always known that I was going to have to spend extensive time interviewing him. As my brother emerged as a big character in the book, it became clear that I was going to have to spend extensive time interviewing him, and also extensive time interviewing my mother, who probably knows the three of us better than anyone.
You talk about your father's sojourn into race consciousness, about him listening to Bob Dylan and Stax during his time in Vietnam.
Yes.
And his later induction into the Black Panther Party. How is that different from your own coming-of-age race consciousness?
Well, first of all, my dad last saw his father alive when he was 9 years old. So to him, it was this, like, he had no, like, whereas I had a framework, I had, you know, this was the sort of how I was brought up, even though I rejected it for many years, as a child. My dad, he, you know, a new world basically opened up to him, in his, late teens and in his early 20s when he was off in the army. And it was just something completely different for him. Whereas I almost took it, I literally did take it for granted. He just didn't have that opportunity.
Let's, take a phone call. Michael in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the author, the guest, to tell the audience about his first name and if it means anything, if it's symbolic of it's an interesting
right.
First name.
Okay, and it's Ta-Nehisi. Is that your given name?
That is my given name. It's so funny. When I went off to college, it was in the early 90s, and everybody wanted to change their name to an African name, and I already had one. And for so long, I had wished I had an ordinary name, but I did not. Ta-Nehisi is a geographical reference to ancient Nubia, which was just south of Egypt. And my dad, you know, on the way to the hospital, was trying to find something that was appropriate. And so he went through several of his books, talked to some folks, and he came up with this, and he thought it just had great symbolic meaning.
Fred in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Hey, I just came in the house and heard the show and had to call. My father just passed away in April, and so I was reflecting on what your listener was saying. I actually grew up in Croton-on-Hudson, which is two towns away from Tarrytown, as a black child and pretty much an all-white community. So my situation, I hear that a lot of things in common, but some things are differences. First of all, that my father was what I would call a race man, and one of these black guys that was quiet but knew his history, understood his history, wasn't a member of the Black Panther Party, but was a very solid man as far as his culture and ethnicity. So raising up three black boys in this white town was not a small task at all. And he did a wonderful job, and at his memorial, several black men got up in the audience of the church and just commended my dad on the example he was. So, you know, just listening, growing up in Baltimore, growing up in a white town in Westchester County was not easy at all.
Right.
Trying to identify, you know, who I am, what am I supposed to be, who am I supposed to identify with.
Right.
And did you wind up as less of a race man, if that's the right term?
Well, my I'll give you my first and my middle name. My name is Frederick Douglass. And so my parents had a very, very good sense of their conscience. Two other brothers, one named after Thurgood Marshall, the other one named after A. Philip Randolph. So that's the kind of parents I had. And now I am an associate professor of history and director of an African diaspora program. So that's what I do now.
All right. Fred, thank you very much. Here's a passage from your book. And again, my